On Saturday, April 2nd, 2011, documentary filmmaker Kevin Edds spoke with the UVA Club of Charlottesville to give a history lesson on UVA football. Edds' documentary, Wahoo Wah, tells the story of the early history of the Cavaliers.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I really appreciate it. I was playing this song a second ago, and I got this song from the Library of Congress. It's from 1941. It was a national radio broadcast of the UVA Glee Club. Anyone has heard that probably since 1941. The fact that there was a recording of that song was just amazing. I'm so glad to be able to grab that. So anyway, thank you again for coming. I really appreciate it. I hope that we can talk about some really fun things about UVA football that you did not hear in the documentary. Out of curiosity, how many folks saw the documentary? A couple of you guys? Well, cool. I'm going to try to give some new information maybe I'll touch on some of the things that you also heard in the documentary. This guy right here is Raymond Bice. The last time I was in this room was in 1990, and Professor Bice was a professor here from 1948 to 1990, and he taught, I believe it was 27,000 students here, 91 consecutive semesters. And my first real brush with UVA football was in this room where Professor Bice had this device here that he created. He loved demonstrations, and he would usually try to pick a football player out of the crowd. So a UVA football player came, sat, and put this thing on his ears, and it was called, let me get this right, an electric pseudonym. And it would he would have the football player say a nursery rhyme like Mary Had a Little Lamb, and it would play his own voice back 1/10 of a second afterwards. And it caused the brain to just go into hyperdrive, and he just started mumbling, and it was the funniest thing that we heard, and it was great to see this, you know, big man on campus, football player, sitting here mumbling up here in my very first class at UVA. So I just wanted to share that with you guys. Do we have any former football players here? I think we have a couple. Great. Awesome. So if I get anything wrong, you guys will feel free to correct me, right? Okay. Okay, my son. Real quick, I just want to let you guys know, this is a book by a UVA alumnus named John Watterson, who lives here in Charlottesville. He is one of the preeminent college football historians. One of the major themes of my film is UVA being at the forefront in so many issues in college football, from eligibility guidelines in the early 1900s. Dr. Lambeth was very influential in that, in making things, in creating an eligibility standard that was then, I think, used by the NCAA across the country. You can only play for 4 years. You have to be attending class, things like that. If your transfers have to be in school for 1 year before they can play. Also, the rules of the game. If you guys saw the documentary, you saw how in 1909, UVA President Alderman and Dr. Lambeth again were very influential in changing the rules of the game to make it safer. Also, scholarship reform, too. UVA was at the forefront of that in 1950 when they were almost expelled from the NCAA for pushing back on this new code called the Sanity Code. So, yet again, I think it's pretty amazing that a UVA person is helping lead, be a leader in the sport of college football. And with historical analysis of the games, is a fantastic book. And if you want to check it out afterwards, I have it right here. Also, this is a ball that from the 1930s. It's a replica, actually. I just thought I'd pass it around for you guys to take a look at it, because we'll be talking about a lot of football in the old days, and you can see what they had to deal with. I think it's a little bit lighter maybe than footballs were back then, but the shape, I think, is great. One other last plug is for my good friend Coy Barefoot, who wrote a book called The Corner, The History of Student Life at the University of Virginia. Fantastic book. It's at the bookstore. Coy was in the documentary. It's great. It really details student life at UVA, things that are just so amazing. He could have made it probably added an extra 100 pages if he was able to include the athletic history that he had found at Alderman Library, but they did not. But he was able to share that with me, and I'm very thankful to him for that. Okay, so UVA football history here. Let's start at the beginning. Some historians say that George Washington like to play catch with the ball. It was probably with something like a soccer ball, but they said that, you know, he was very a big fan of playing catch. Another one of our founding fathers, not founding father, but a great president at the time, Abraham Lincoln, he was an accomplished wrestler. But what did the founder of the university, Thomas Jefferson, what would he have said about sports? Or what would he said about the sport of football in particular? Jefferson said, games played with the ball are too violent for the body and stamp no character on the mind. So, well, even though he may not have been pleased by his students taking up the sport of football, I think he would have been proud to know that at least UVA was in the forefront of its development on so many fronts and fought to make the game safe and to make the game fair. I was actually at Monticello yesterday, and you can see he still has his sign up there saying no football allowed. So, okay, even though Jefferson would not have been happy with it, does anyone know where the very first games of football were played at the university? The very first time anyone ever played the game of football in any capacity. You got it right. The lawn. In 1870, just 1 year after the first officially recognized college football game took place in 1869 between Princeton and Rutgers, UVA students were going to a math class, and the math class was canceled. And I guess they were upset because they were. The story goes that professors could hear cursing as the students were returning to their rooms on the lawn. At that point, an impromptu game of football took place on the lawn, and it became very, very popular. Unfortunately, it was played usually 100 per side, so it was a little different than the games today. But they were actually banned from playing football on the lawn because of all the yelling and the cursing and people getting hurt. They wanted, you know, Jefferson's academical village, you know, they wanted to keep it pristine. So they also played over right in front of Alderman Library. And you know that little grassy area there? That was Professor Mallett had a house right there. And they played games there. They also played on the hill that slopes down next to the rotunda going down towards the corner. So that was another place they played. Let me ask this question also. When UVA played their very first organized game against outside competition, does anyone know where that happened? That would be here at Mad Bowl. This is one of the earliest pictures we have of Mad Bowl. Obviously, there's no football field here. It's a track. This is, I think, from 1905, I believe. But you can see that it would have been a pretty nice field there. But does anyone know why it didn't necessarily work out? Why they felt that they had to find yet another place to play football. Mud is great. Also, attendance. There would be issues with getting paying customers. So it'd be too easy for people to come and sit on the hill, to stand on Rugby Road, stand on Madison Lane and watch the game. They wanted to raise money for that. So in order to do that, they had to find a place where they could put up a fence. You have a question yet? Those are the corners of the track. So when the track guys would be running around the corner so they wouldn't slip and slide. Exactly. Yeah. And I guess they put the planks down because it got so muddy and that, you know, helped that. So they needed to find a place where they could put up a fence, but everyone knows how beautiful the university is. You know, no one wants to put up an ugly wooden fence anywhere. So they found a location. And this is an aerial from 1931. You can see Scott Stadium way up there. And I think you can see the rotunda right there. And do you see the little area to the east, which actually is just down a little bit from Scott Stadium where those dirt lines are there, where it looks like there was parking? That is the location. I'll click to a close-up of that. That is the location of the very first football stadium at the University of Virginia. Unfortunately, we don't have any wide shots of that. We do have this picture, though, coming up here, which is of a baseball game in the 1890s. It looks like that field actually had a little bit of a slope to it, too. What's amazing to me is that these guys in this picture are probably 20 years old, and this is in 1890. And as we were discussing earlier, Dr. Risher, who's in my documentary, who's 100 years old and played in 1931, what's amazing to me is that these guys right here, they would have been about 60 years old when Dr. Risher was playing. So it's conceivable that Dr. Risher once met some of the very first baseball and football players of the University of Virginia. And Dr. Risher still comes to games today and works for the stats crew. So it's amazing to me that we still have that link to our legacy there, the very first football players. This is another picture here. While I did not have confirmation from the Special Collections Library, I pretty much have narrowed down that this is probably the very first intercollegiate football game at the University of Virginia against Johns Hopkins. I've studied the uniforms that the players are wearing here and in the photos of the very first team. I believe that this is 1888 Johns Hopkins at that very same field that I was just showing you a little earlier next to Scott Stadium there. It's really interesting that, you know, you can see those folks there in the left-hand corner next to the goalpost. Those are the very first tailgaters ever in University of Virginia history. Yeah, absolutely. And they'd ride their wagons out there so they could get a better view of the game standing up on their wagons. And it looks like they're having a good old time. People are all dressed up. I think that tradition of dressing up at football games maybe started that day. I'll show you again. Let me go back up. It was right next to Scott Stadium. And you see that dirt field where parking occurred right next to the trees? That is where that fence, it used to be a fenced-in area right there. And the story goes, if you can see Dawson's Row, I wish I had my pointer here, is that open green area there, Dawson's Row dormitories were there. And there were complaints in the student newspaper, Daily Topics, that students were climbing the trees to watch the games for free and not paying the 25-cent admission to get in. So today, if you guys go over to the spring game or go over to the lacrosse game and you're walking through that parking lot, you're probably walking right across the 50-yard line of the very first stadium here at the University of Virginia. And there's our picture there. Great. Oh, thank you so much. Let's see if this. Oh, now we have a pointer. Okay. Okay. For those of you that saw my documentary, we mentioned the legend of the very first game between the University of Virginia and Washington and Lee in 1871 that unfortunately we could not find a score. But the very first formally organized football team that you see here that was truly set up to start playing an outside schedule actually hit the field in 1887, the year prior. This is a picture from the spring of 88. So they were playing their first game. Does anyone know where they played their very, very first game? I know I had mentioned before on grounds, but their very first game was played at Pantops Mountain against Pantops Academy. And that was in the fall of 1887. The athletic department administration likes to say that 1888 was the first season because that's the first year they played an intercollegiate team. But actually, it was the 1887/88, the spring of 88 season, that I think was the very first team. Two of the guys that we see here, and I'll use my pointer again, are right here. This is Charles Wilcox. He was from New York, Governor's Island, New York. And he went to Yale as an undergraduate and came to the University of Virginia in 1886 as a grad student in law school. And Richard Reed Rogers right there was from Princeton, and he was also a graduate student. He went to Princeton for undergrad, and I think he was in the medical school here. These two gentlemen right here are the guys that got the very first football team started at UVA. They'd seen the powerhouse teams at Princeton, Yale, and Harvard, and they came here. They said, why is there not a football team here? So they organized a team. They had a president, a treasurer. They collected money because they had to pay for their own uniforms. They had to pay for the footballs that they needed for the upgrade of the field when they needed to. This is an interesting group of men, though. You know, most of them, as I said, were law school, medical school students, and many were the sons of Civil War veterans. And most people would think UVA, Virginia, you know, they must be sons of Confederate soldiers. And while this was true in some cases, we have, let's see, John Randolph Bryan Jr. Right here on the right. And his father was famous, actually, for being the very first Confederate aeronaut. He flew a hot air balloon at the Battle of Yorktown to scout Union troops. On his third mission, the rope that held the balloon broke, It entangled someone around the leg and started to pick them up. They cut the rope. The balloon took off, and it blew across Union lines. So he is sitting there, scared to death, in this balloon, 4 miles in the air, at the same time taking pretty good notes of where everyone is located, just in case he's going to actually make it back. Fortunately, the wind blew back and blew him back across to the southern side of things. It drifted across the York River. He almost crashed in the York River, landed in an orchard, and was safe, and refused to ever fly again. So we have a very interesting story there. So back to that very first team. So Brian's son was on this very first team, but his teammates, though, were from all across the country. They had players from Virginia, Accomack, Sperryville, Mount Sterling, Kentucky, but they also had players from places like Illinois, Utah, New York, and even the Sandwich Islands. You guys know what the Sandwich Islands are? It's actually called Hawaii now. I did not know that. So they had guys from all over the country here. Richard Reed Rogers, he was from Kentucky, and as I said, Charles Wilcox is from New York. So these two guys came from families that were on opposite sides of the Civil War, but they had one thing in common. They knew what real football was like. So that first season in 1887, does anyone know what the colors of the UVA uniforms were then? Absolutely, gray and red. So it was silver gray and cardinal red, symbolizing the Confederacy and the blood shed on them. But these colors had actually first been used by the UVA baseball team that began playing in 1870 or so. And those guys were actually Confederate veterans. But in 1888, we have a whole new generation of students here that came from all across the country. So the gray and red colors were probably not very pleasing to them that they came from the North. These guys coming from Union families having to wear gray and red. So here is a piece of artwork. I think that this was put on a little piece of silk that was included in tobacco, smoking tobacco that they sold around Charlottesville. And I think different schools all across the country had pictures of their players in that manner. And here we have a UVA student next to him, too, so you kind of see what the uniform looked like back then. These colors are really cool to me, too, because look what happened after they did that. The University of Auburn ends up copying UVA's color scheme. Yes, this year's national champion, Auburn Tigers, took not only their school colors, but also the nickname, the Auburn Tigers. The University of Virginia used to be known as the Virginia Tigers. When we go back to this, local sports writers called Virginia the Virginia Tigers because of the stripes there. So the University of Auburn actually takes their colors and their nickname from us. It was a UVA student named George Petrie, who graduated from UVA in 1887. And 5 years later, he founded Auburn's history department and their football team. And as a gift, his secretary secretly sewed uniforms for the very first squad, and she picked orange and blue, and that was for their very first game against Alabama. So they go out there to play. They didn't even think they were going to have uniforms, and they have these orange and blue uniforms that was done because of his allegiance to the University of Virginia. Also, we have University of Florida, who takes their colors from UVA also. And this is interesting because a UVA student in 1907 was from Gainesville, Florida. His father came up here to visit him. They were walking around the corner, and he saw these pennants, these UVA pennants in the stores, and he thought they were great. And he owned a sundry shop back in Gainesville, and he wanted to have some for the University of Florida. So he went and he talked to the owner of the store here on the corner, and he said, you know, how can I get some of these University of Florida? And he said, well, first you need a mascot. So his son, who was a student here in 1907, went to Alderman Library, and he went and picked out a book on Florida, and he found that the alligator was, you know, one of the most popular animals there in the state of Florida, and found a picture of it. So he drew a picture of a gator, which is, I think, very, very similar to this. And his father ordered pennants, and when he got back to Florida and they arrived, well, they were orange and blue. And that was the only colors that the manufacturers had here in Charlottesville. So University of Florida also has their colors based on University of Virginia's. Let's see here. All right. This is an interesting quote that we get from College Topics, which, again, is the Cavalier Daily, which started in 1890. This is from January 1890. We're at the dawn of a new era. Interest in football is being awakened everywhere at the University of Virginia and is moving right along with the procession. Our team had every right to be classed among the leading football 11s of the country, having acquitted themselves gloriously in many a hard-fought struggle. The team played well, and our football enthusiasts say that our team in 1890 will write its name high in the annals of collegiate football in America. That's a great statement. It's funny that they say that, because the very first two games in 1890, University of Virginia lost 72-0 to Pennsylvania and 115-0 to Princeton. Actually, I think I got those two scores backwards. And that was a doubleheader weekend in Washington, D.C. On a Friday, and a game Saturday in Baltimore. It's interesting that comment showed up in the student newspaper, because the student newspaper was created by the athletic department. It was a way to promote the football team. So they thought, this is a way for people to know when the games are, who's playing, who's injured, you know, what the schedule is going to be, how practice is going. Oh, we should probably throw in a little bit of real news in there too. So they had a few people doing real news reporting around the university. Let's go back here. So, University of Virginia loses these first two games, just absolutely crushed. So what do? They give up.
They go.
I do not think they did. Princeton actually was the reigning national champion from the year before, and Pennsylvania that season that they lost would be the national champion that year too. Did they pack it in? Did they quit? No, they said, we need some more talent. So here's what happens. We get this account from a book called In the Days of My Youth by James Southall, who attended the University of Virginia from 1888 to 1893. It was plain to see that we could never hope to overtake the seasoned colleges in the North. Unquestionably, we had some good native material for outdoor sports. That first encounter was so humiliating and at the same time so enlightening that we set to work the next year to pay back the score. In the interim, we had ransacked the wilds of Albemarle County and found at last a mighty giant in the person of Big Billy Garth. Him, therefore, we fetched from his father's farm and drilled day and night to play center rush on our team. He proved to be a formidable obstacle to our opponents and stood his ground with all the stubbornness of an ox that refuses to yield an inch. So we have a drawing here from the university's first season there in 1890. Let me get my pointer here again. These are the victories against Washington and Lee, Dickinson, Trinity, which is now known as Duke, Lafayette, and Randolph-Macon. These are the two losses. They incorrectly have 62-0 and 115-0. And there's Billy. There is Big Billy Garth. He weighs in at 248 pounds. Now, you've got guys on this team, and if we go back, who are probably no more than 150 pounds. I'm not 100% sure, but I think this could be Billy here with the mustache. And if I did my math right, we were trying to find my friend Ann Southwell at the Special Collections Library. We were trying to find a William Garth in the records, and we found one. He would be 27 years old, which is not out of the question. So a 27-year-old law student. He actually, when they got him, he attended the law school here, and for 2 years too. So fortunately, he held his own in the classroom. We can all keep our heads high for that. So let's move along here. Back to here. Okay. Let me move along here. There we go. Okay. Does anyone know who these two gentlemen are? Probably not. It's pretty random. These were the first two men that made the very first legal forward pass. Bradbury Robinson is on the left from the University of St. Louis University, and he threw an incomplete pass to teammate Jack Schneider on the right in the very first legal pass attempt in college football history. The ball, though, you guys were passing around the ball from the 1930s. You could tell that was a little bit bigger than a ball today. The ball before then actually was even bigger than that. And it was still really risky to, I'm kidding here, it was really risky to pass. This is Bradbury Robinson. He was known for having really large fingers, a very large hand, and was a fantastic passer for someone, you know, in a sport where passing had never been done before. So before that, though, some passes were made illegally. In 1876, during the Yale-Princeton game, a player was about to be tackled when he coughed up the ball to a teammate who was standing next to him, who caught the ball and ran in for a touchdown. Princeton protested, but the referee didn't know what to do, so he flipped a coin. And Princeton won it, so the touchdown counted. The very first football pass for a touchdown, illegal though it was, that was counted to the record books. Another prominent mention of a forward pass here before it came legal was from a game in 1895 between UNC and Georgia. UNC fullback dropped back to punt and was about to be tackled. And he also, just scared of the massive players coming at him, just threw the ball to someone else, don't tackle me, who ran for a 70-yard touchdown. Pop Warner, heard of Pop Warner football. He was actually the coach of Georgia that day, and he was stunned, protested, yelled, screamed, almost got kicked out of the game. But the referee said he didn't see the play too well. He didn't really know what had happened, so the touchdown was allowed. So back to our team here in 1890. Let me go back just a moment. Okay. Gotten rid of it. I was going to read to you also another, my apologies, account of the game in 1890. Sorry about that. Talking again about Big Billy Garth here, and I apologize for losing this other account from the book. The interesting thing that I found from the book that talked about ransacking the wilds of Albemarle County and finding Big Billy Garth was that the next year, the University of Virginia team was very excited. They have this guy who's so huge, he's so big, he's playing center rush, and looking forward to it. A guy known as Captain Paul Daschle, who was a very famous football player from those early days, flummoxed Billy with the forward pass. And I was reading this account, and I thought, well, that's really interesting. And then I was looking at the date, and it was 1890. And I thought, well, what's going on there? And it turns out that It turns out that Southall's account of this game in 1890 showed that an entire game plan revolved around the forward pass. It was 16 years before the forward pass became legal. So one can only assume, you know, that since very few football games had ever been played in the South, that University of Virginia players weren't too sure about the rules in some cases. Visiting teams, when they came down, would sometimes bring the referee with them. So I find it really fascinating that the forward pass actually, not so much as an accident, as we as I told you about in the game between Georgia and UNC and the other game with Princeton in 1876, but an entire game plan was revolved around the forward pass here on the grounds of the University of Virginia. They thought they could pull one over on this very first ever team from the South. Looking here, this is an advertisement for that doubleheader weekend in 1890 with UVA and Princeton. An interesting side note here, the sports writers in Virginia called the University of Virginia the Tigers at that time. Princeton was also the Tigers, probably because, you know, they also had dark blue or black and orange stripes there too. So when people were reading the account the next day in the newspaper, both fans probably had to look twice to figure out which Tigers it was that won that game 72-0. Does anyone know who this gentleman is right here? This is the coach of Princeton that year in 1890, new Princeton government professor Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was an undergraduate at Princeton from 1874 to 1879, and he became obsessed with football. While he never played, he coached the team, managed the team, he wrote articles in the student newspaper, he sold tickets, he promoted it wherever he could. He was the biggest football fan around. He led them to a 6-0 season in 1878, and the very first Big Three championship between Harvard, Princeton, and Yale. They awarded a trophy there to the winner of that season's games between Yale, Harvard, and Princeton. Let's see here. He was a Virginia native, too, and he came back to his home state that fall in 1879. One second here. To attend law school here. I'm just trying to catch up with myself here. To attend law school. And one would have thought that maybe he would have started a football team here. And so I called the Woodrow Wilson Library in Stanton, Virginia, and I asked them if they could look through their records, if I could look through their records to see if there was any mention of football at all in Woodrow Wilson's letters during that year. And they said no, but interestingly enough, Woodrow Wilson actually left the university every weekend. Every weekend he was gone, and they said that the people at the library, the Woodrow Wilson Library, said that the best they can assume is that he was going to visit a lady that he was courting, possibly in Washington, D.C. Well, it's only a five-hour train ride from here to Philly, and then another 30 minutes to Princeton. So it's conceivable that Woodrow Wilson actually was going up to Princeton while he was a student at the University of Virginia to coach the Princeton football team. I actually found an account in a book that stated that he was the coach of the football team there in 1879. So I think that would be amazing that the University of Virginia had a student here that was also the coach of a national championship football team. I think that's pretty amazing. Here's another great account of how much Woodrow Wilson loved football. He went to Wesleyan in 1888 as a professor of history. So after he went to law school here at the University of Virginia, he practiced a little bit, then he became professor of history and political science at Wesleyan. He also served as their football coach, and he was the faculty director of the Football Association. A Wesleyan alumnus remembered Wilson as, and I quote, "a tall, thin man running up and down these very sidelines during the afternoon's football practice, waving his closed umbrella in the air and cheering encouragement at the top of his lungs on almost every play." All right, we have an account here. This is from the Princetonian. Maybe this talks about the 11's southern trip down south to play the University of Virginia. Okay, I want to take a moment to dispel a myth here about UVA football. People say while UVA had a few eras where they had a good football team, you know, in 1941 with Bill Dudley, in the late 40s with Coach Art Gepp, in the late 80s and 90s with George Welsh, you know, in a few good years with Al Groh, they say UVA never had any sustained success. Well, I want to disagree with that, because from 1888 to 1950, the first 29 seasons of UVA football, they never had a losing season. UVA had a winning record their very first 29 seasons. The program here was a standard bearer for all of the teams in the South until World War I. They won the championship of the South many, many, many times. And excluding games against Ivy powerhouses and also small schools like Randolph-Macon and University of Richmond, Virginia dominated their Southern opponents here. They went 68-10-4. 4-0 against Georgia, as you can see. 17-4-1 against UNC. You know, these were the preeminent programs in the South. You know, not just that those first couple of years where they were just first starting their football team, but for the first three decades of college football in the South. So if anyone says that UVA never had a great football team, the first 30 years of college football in the South, UVA was the forerunner there. All right, so moving on here. If you've seen the documentary, you know how dangerous football here was in the early years. You saw how in 1909, a UVA football player named Archer Christian, his death at a game at Georgetown was the catalyst that ignited the outcry against violence in football. Here's an interesting quote from a player named Murray McGuire, who wrote about UVA football coach John Poe from 1893. I don't think Poe is in this team picture here, but this was his football squad here. John Poe played on the Princeton team in 1890 that beat UVA so badly, and then UVA hired him in 1893. Here's a quote from a UVA football player, Murray McGuire. We knew no football at all when Poe took us in hand. This was the day when piling up was allowed. Poe was teaching the game to pile up, and he himself fell on the ball and instructed the players forthwith to pile on him. As he was coach, they left him a little room to breathe. He expressed this greatest dissatisfaction and yelled at the top of his voice that no one was on his head. He had no further cause to complain that day or the succeeding day because of the consideration shown his feelings or his head. So the University of Virginia learned quickly from their coach, John Poe, that football was a violent sport, and he was mad. He said, "Jump on my head. When I fall on this ball, you jump on top of me. You do everything that you can to hurt me if you have to." So that was the way that football was played back then. Let me just go back up here. To illustrate the dangers of football here, I want to also share with you a letter from my friend Ann Southwell at the Special Collections Library. She was someone that was really, really instrumental in helping me get some information that I needed for the documentary. Really, really thankful to her. These are excerpts from a series of letters that she reviewed in the archives from the 1895 season. And I believe one of the players in this picture wrote these. And this is, I'm going to read this in Anne's voice, because I think she has some very funny observations about this. Dear Kevin, I've just been rereading a series of letters from William Poindexter Moore, son of a Confederate veteran and a football player for the 1895 season. On November 2nd, he wrote, "I've gotten all the skin back on my face now." I couldn't find a letter explaining how he lost it. He noted that he plays football two or three evenings every week and, by accident, broke a man's nose. The doctor says he thinks he can fix it up. In the letter, there was a question mark by accident. Ann doesn't know whether the question mark was his or not, whether or not that really was intentional. Unfortunately, by December 11th, he's writing from the UVA infirmary. He twisted a knee. To keep the swelling down, someone put hot water on it. The water was so hot, he got a blister, which was then painted with iodine. He ended up with a lot of dead skin, which he then picked off with his fingernails. When he took the bandage off, he caught cold in it, which I presume meant he got a bad infection, which caused matter to form. Back to the hospital. The doctor cut it open so that it could drain. He was not allowed to walk for 2 weeks. On December 17th, the doctor writes to the parents that Poindexter has not recovered and is still in the infirmary. He assures them that there is no injury to the joint. This is only a temporary disablement, and Christian needs to keep his leg quiet. On January 7th of the following year, Poindexter writes home that his knee is still stiff, but he can bend it enough to sit down. His muscles are sore, and it was hard to go up and down steps. On January 25th, 2 weeks later, he writes that he's nearly well, and he can bend his knee to an angle of 30 degrees, and his scab is off. He hopes to play baseball in the spring season. On January 30th, though, he's still in the hospital, but notes that the preacher comes every morning at 9 and talks football with him. Unfortunately, he never played football again, and was so far behind in his studies that he dropped out after 1 year. He worked for the Virginia Agricultural Extension Agency for many years, all of which leads me to conclude that medicine was deadlier than football in 1895. Anne. So I thought that was very funny. Not funny, sad for him, obviously, but the life of a football player at UVA and the medicine that was around then in case you got injured. This is a picture here of, actually it's a scan of a postcard that we got of the 1909 University of Virginia game against Georgetown in 1809. And in the documentary, as I mentioned, Archer Christian, his death, we think that that might be Archer Christian right there, not wearing a helmet. And in the second half of that game, he hit a line of players and was thrown backwards, and his head hit the ground, causing a great injury, a brain injury. He died the next morning. And this was the catalyst, as I mentioned, to the reform of college football and changing the rules. As I was at the Alumni Association doing research for this, I was scanning these postcards, and I this might actually be a Georgetown player here carrying the ball. I'm not sure, but it was very it's a very emotional story, very sad one. The whole university community was just distraught. The chapel next to the rotunda, if you go inside there and look to the right, there is a marble monument basically to Archer Christian that you can check out. It's been there for 100 years. It was 101, actually I think it was this year, 100 years that was erected. As I was going through these postcards and looking at them, just thinking about this story and how sad it was, I came across the back of one of the postcards, and it says, "I'm sending you two more pictures of the game which are not available when I mail the others. I'm glad to see the one of Christian. I leave here at 9 p.m. tomorrow for New York and shall return Tuesday in all probability. This has been about the longest week I've ever spent. The chateau seems deserted again. Faithfully yours, A.L." After a lot of looking around, I thought maybe that was William Lambeth. Actually, it turns out that was Albert Lefevre, and folks might recognize that name from Lefevre Dormitory, I think it is. Anyway, it just shows me how sad the entire community was. The chateau was Pop Lanigan. He was the trainer. Was his house, which is actually used to stand right behind Alderman Library. It was this really, really cool little house. It actually had a little moat around it, had a little bridge across it, and all the football players would hang out there. It was like a meeting place. And as Lefevre says here, the chateau seemed deserted again. So you can only imagine how sad it was here at that time. Does anyone know what this device is here? This is called a grid graph. Before television or even radio, the only way to enjoy a Virginia football game was to attend one. But when the team went on the road, and students were, you know, couldn't miss the classes to take the train to go see the game, fans found a new ingenious way to experience the game in a vacant corner, vacant store on the corner. The first time we hear about this is 1904, when UVA traveled to play the University of Pennsylvania. With a desire to find out the results of the contest sooner than could be reported in the morning paper, fans flocked to this corner store to hear each account transcribed on telegraph messages. Cheers, moans, and the singing of the good old song filled the store after each and every reading of the messages. So after every play in 1904, actually this is before this device was created, students would first go and listen to a telegraph message of each and every play. But in 1925, they took the idea even further by creating this. And in Cabell Hall, this grid graph was installed, and it was lit up with lights. And when University of Virginia went to play Georgia down in Athens in 1925, this mysterious invention was unveiled. Jefferson's original layout of the university grounds intended for the area at the south end of the lawn to showcase an open view of the mountains. So that when you graduate and you turn and you look, you're going to see the world ahead of you in the future. Cabell Hall was then built, which blocked that view. But while the need for classrooms brought about the building of Cabell Hall here, a vision of the future was on display that day when the grid graph was there. The future of the internet, possibly. People watch, see games on the internet. So students gathered there to witness the unveiling of this. Telegraph messages would be sent to Cabell Hall here. Small lights representing each player would light up when they carried the ball. The words kick, run, and pass would light up and be illuminated according to the plays. That was a very cool invention there. By 1933, Virginia was playing away games at Ohio State, and they augmented not only the account of the game with the grid graph, but also with radio accounts of it. So that was a really, that just showed how much UVA fans wanted to get the information as soon as possible. This invention was created. Yes. Notre Dame used it. Many other colleges used it too. So I don't know how they raised the funds to get it, but it's a pretty cool device there. So Alfie, how much more time do you think we have? Okay. We're going to go to about 5 minutes? Okay, cool. I was going to talk to you about the Gooch Report, which some of you may have heard about. This is actually Professor Gooch here. I might save that for another time here. I have another great story. I have so many great stories here that I'd love to tell you guys. Tell you what. What's that? Lacrosse game starts at noon. So I'll be very quick. Okay. These are a couple quick pictures here of George Welsh when he was a player at Navy. People know George Welsh as a coach, but they don't realize how good of a football player he was. He was so good that Life magazine sent a world-renowned photographer to take these pictures of him over a weekend. He came back with these amazing pictures. Love this one of him on the right. He's screaming encouragement there. Here's another one here. He looks so young there. Another one here of him studying in class. He was even on the cover of Stanley Woodward's football magazine here. So that I can take some questions here, I will move quicker. I want to show you guys something. George Welsh led UVA to unprecedented heights. And this is a nice little flashback that I had never seen before until just the other day. I thought I'd share it with you.
Hello, welcome to the show. I'm Dan Patrick along with Gary Miller, and we start with college football and start at the top. They've heard the cry, we're number one in Charlottesville, Virginia before, but not pertaining to this sport.
Some of the polls come out on Sunday, so it may not be big news on Monday, but beating Clemson, they thought that was big. If you went into the beginning of the year and said Virginia is going to be number one, well, there they are. How long can they keep it, though? You can understand it with Ralph Sampson, and it's happened just last week in lacrosse, but somehow it didn't make as big a news in Charlottesville. Could it be that Virginia is the number one team in all of college football? Last week, the national newspaper went out on a limb and picked the Cavaliers for that spot. But now that limb has grown thick with pollsters who all feel that at 6-0, Virginia deserves the honor. They're number one in a lot of things. Mascot isn't bad either. Number 5 in rushing offense, number 1 in passing offense with Sean Moore, number 1 in total offense in the nation, and now number 1 in the world of college football. They did it. They're not ready to point fingers, but the student body is.
I'll tell you what, it's hard to keep a level head when you think about the teams we're up here with.
Chris Lane.
We're ahead of Miami, we're ahead of Notre Dame, we're ahead of, you know, all the great teams have been up here before. And it's just wonderful.
It's good that people consider us that high, you know, in the rankings. But, you know, we focus in week in and week out, and I think we did a good job this week of just taking care of what we had to do.
We certainly can't deny the fact that, you know, that we've been voted number one, but I haven't changed my mind about the polls and that really doesn't mean anything. We're the fourth number one, if I think I'm right, since the season started, and we've only played 6 games. So we have to deal with it, but let's not dwell on it and don't talk about it the rest of the week.
There you go. That was 1990. People thought that that would never, ever, ever happen. I'll leave you now with one last thought. In 1893, UVA students traveled to the state capital of Richmond to watch a game against the University of Richmond, University of Virginia, and a reporter for Daily Topics, the Cavalier Daily, who covered the event, had this to say. One of the most gratifying features of the Thanksgiving game in Richmond was the presence of a large and enthusiastic contingent of alumni of the university. They were much in evidence with colors, flowers, etc., and they sang and cried wahoo wah quite enthusiastically. All honor to such loyal alumni. We call the attention to the powers that be that athletics may yet solve the problem of binding the alumni more closely to the university. To me, football is more than a sport. It's a spectacle. It's an event. It's something that makes us feel like we're part of a larger group. You know, it thrills us, saddens us sometimes, and it binds us. I love learning about the first 140 years of history of the University of Virginia football team, and I hope that the university can continue to lead by example, both on and off the field. And I look forward to the next 140 years. So thank you guys for coming out today. I really appreciate it.